I next met with Dr. Nina Shah. To begin, she commented on recently approved and novel antibodies for patients with myeloma.
I think the two major targets for antibody therapy for myeloma are SLAMF7, which is targeted by elotuzumab, and CD38, which is targeted both by daratumumab and the up-and-coming isatuximab. And I think antibody therapy in myeloma has really just skyrocketed in use. And the reason for that is before, we really didn't have good antigens. And it's not that nobody tried, just we didn't have good targets that would really kill the myeloma cells if they were targeted appropriately. So just looking at elotuzumab, it does target SLAMF7. And this is known to be expressed on malignant plasma cells. And it works by taking the NK cells and using ADCC, although there may be some other activating mechanisms on NK cells themselves because they also express SLAMF7 and ironically are not negatively impacted, it's thought, by the presence of elotuzumab. What we know about elotuzumab is that it does not have very good single agent activity, but in combination with lenalidomide or now pomalidomide, it does seem to have a nice increase in activity over len or pom alone with dexamethasone. And because of this, this actually lends a little more gravitas to the idea that lenalidomide or pomalidomide are working in an immunomodulatory way because it's working well with an antibody. We know from the Eloquent studies that elo-len-dex was superior to len-dex in patients with relapsed myeloma. And although that study was very positive, one of the difficult things is the patient population in those studies did not necessarily reflect the patients that we now see in our clinic who've had relapsed disease. But most recently, last year, with the publication of the elo-pom-dex data, which showed a very nice almost doubling of PFS, and this is in patients with two or more prior lines, we do now have this as an option, I think, that's more viable for our current clinical practice, and that's what I see being used a lot more in the community now. So that's how elotuzumab works.
You know, it's kind of been a little bit confusing to me where elo actually fits in practically. Can you kind of describe a clinical scenario where that's what you'd be thinking about?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think, as I was mentioning, the elo-pom-dex data actually has helped us to put elo in a place. So, for example, if you had a patient who had bortezomib, lenalidomide, dexamethasone, and had gotten four cycles and then transplant and then maintenance lenalidomide and then progressed, maybe you would have, in the first line treatment, given them a carfilzomib-based therapy, but maybe they had a biochemical progression after a few cycles. That would be a good place to use elotuzumab, pomalidomide, and dexamethasone, meaning that this patient had had two lines of therapy and had not been exposed to this particular antibody or immunotherapy. So that would be a good place to use this particular therapy. One thing that's good about the elo-pom-dex regimen, pretty well tolerated. Surprisingly, the neutropenia was not worse in the elo-pom-dex arm versus the pom-dex arm. Some older patients can tolerate this pretty well. Infusion reactions are pretty well tolerated. And they made the schedule pretty user-friendly because you get the 8 weeks of therapy, but then it converts to monthly therapy or every 4 weeks. So I think this is something that's actually very user-friendly for a lot of community practitioners whose patients would be coming in anyway on a monthly basis, but maybe don't necessarily want to come every 2 weeks and want to get in and get out just that 1 month visit. So that's where I see this being used.
Where do you see it heading in the future? One of the thoughts that's been out there is using it in combination with an IMiD, particularly lenalidomide, as maintenance after transplant. Is that being looked at? Do you think that is going to become a reality?
Yeah, I think that that's one way to consider using this. That is a study that's ongoing, and we don't have the results yet. When you add anything to anything in myeloma, you get better results usually. So I won't be surprised if that's a good result. The question is at what cost, right? So is it going to be a good enough result to say, okay, we really should be giving every patient antibody therapy? And we'll talk a little bit more about that even in the context of daratumumab. But I do think that elotuzumab, I tend to think of it as a drug that we can use for patients who are having a biochemical progression that would like to consider a therapy that's well tolerated. I don't think there's anything wrong with using it in older populations. They seem to tolerate it well. You do have to modulate your pomalidomide in those situations. So that's kind of where I see it in the future. I think one other thing that's very important for elotuzumab is that if anti-CD38 therapy moves more forward, then elotuzumab will have even more of a role to play in the salvage setting.
Because they'll have already gotten the anti-CD38.
Correct. Right. And we don't know how elotuzumab does in daratumumab, for example, treated patients because there were very few of those on the elo-pom-dex study.
So you mentioned anti-CD38 as another immune strategy, and obviously Dara's out there, but also there's this other agent you mentioned, isatuximab. I'm curious about that and other anti-CD38 strategies. Can you talk about kind of where they fit in and how you see them working?
Yeah, anti-CD38 therapy has really revolutionized myeloma treatment and immunotherapy for myeloma. CD38 is expressed on plasma cells and other cells as well, but is nicely expressed on plasma cell, making it a very good target. We know from the initial phase 1 studies and single-arm phase 2 studies that daratumumab had single-agent activity, as did isatuximab. Daratumumab made a splash on the scene with the Castor and Pollux data showing a really impressive improvement in PFS in combination with either lenalidomide or bortezomib in patients with 1 to 3 prior lines of therapy. With that being said, daratumumab is now one of the things that is considered in the first or second relapse very readily because it is very effective and it's also pretty well tolerated after you get over the first infusion. And with that, we've also learned a lot about how to give daratumumab. And now there's a rapid infusion protocol, 30 minutes, that's available. And eventually subcutaneous, we think, will be available. So that's where daratumumab has been. Interestingly enough, it has not only the mechanism of action of ADCC or working through antibody-dependent cytotoxicity, but is known to have complement fixation and also possibly direct activity through CD38 and then antibody-dependent macrophage-induced phagocytosis. So four mechanisms of actions for daratumumab. Isatuximab, which is also a CD38 antibody at a different site, has actually very similar properties that I can see from the data that's been published. And most recently, there was data presented at ASCO of isa-pom-dex versus pom-dex, and it did show superiority of isa-pom-dex over pom-dex with regard to progression-free survival. It was fairly well tolerated also, and I think that this is another option for us. Where we see it as myeloma doctors trying to put these two together, I think if I had to give an opinion, I'd say that they're probably equivalent. And what's going to happen in the near future is maybe daratumumab has had more studies with upfront use, and so we'll see those sooner, potentially. We don't know. And eventually, it might be a competition, a true market competition between the two drugs as far as which one a practitioner uses.
Well, given the fact there's 6 checkpoint inhibitors approved and 3 CDK inhibitors and 4 PARP inhibitors, I guess that wouldn't be the first time that happened in oncology. But
right.
What do we know by indirect comparison in terms of tolerability, particularly infusion reactions with the two?
Well, actually, both of them are pretty well tolerated on the long term. We know that the infusion requirement for that first infusion for isatuximab is actually a little shorter than daratumumab, as per the study recently presented. I think this is sort of an important point, but sort of not, because ultimately daratumumab is going to go to subcutaneous, and that infusion is obviously much shorter. And even in the first infusion, it's a 4-hour wait period for observation, and thereafter you're kind of home free. So I don't want to put too much into the infusion time because I just don't think that that's going to be relevant in the future.
And you'd mentioned sub-Q therapy, and I think there was some data just presented on that. It looks like it's going to be equivalent.
Yeah, so the Colombo study did look at exploring whether daratumumab subcutaneous is as good as IV daratumumab. And what it was able to show is after the first dose and thereafter as you dose it, you can get very nice steady state levels of drug. And it is similar to the weight-based IV dosing of daratumumab. In addition, there are fewer infusion-related reactions and obviously a much shorter time of injection versus infusion. And so we have data there to show that it's pretty equivalent. And I think this is going to be very helpful for those of us who really need to get our patients in and out of the practice quickly to have a subcutaneous option.
So let's talk about CAR-T. Again, maybe you can talk a little bit about your vision in general for sort of how CAR-T is actually done with the, you know, sort of the biology of CAR-T. And then we'll talk about what we know about that in myeloma.
Right. So CAR-T, as you know, has been more readily and heavily studied in CD19-bearing malignancies, which tend to be either lymphomas or ALL. And only at the end of 2015 did we first hear about BCMA CAR-T therapy for myeloma. BCMA is a member of the TNF receptor family and is expressed uniformly on all plasma cells and nicely is not expressed on really very many other cells. So it's like the perfect target. There doesn't have to be that much of it for CAR-T cells to work. So that's also very good. And most of the more recent studies are not requiring a specific amount of BCMA to be expressed on target cells for patients to be enrolled. With that being said, the initial studies of CAR-T therapy targeting BCMA, there were some toxicities, the NIH study and the Penn study, but that's all been really more rolled out and familiarized, and I think we're getting better. And probably the biggest splash was made by the construct, which was first presented in the spring of 2017, showing initially of greater than 90% 50% response rate for patients with multiply relapsed myeloma. This was the phase one study, and the company very quickly moved on to the phase two, which has completed enrollment but has not been presented yet. Eventually, the data from the phase one study showed a very nice response rate for these patients, and that was very exciting to all of us because it's very difficult to get anything more than a 40% response rate in multiply relapsed patients or even a 30% response rate. And here we were looking upwards greater than 80% response rate in these patients. So something so exciting. But what also came out was that the PFS for these patients was about a year, 11.8 months, although it was improved in patients who achieved MRD negativity. So what does this mean? This means that we have a good target. It means that these T cells are great at killing myeloma. There's patients who had negative bone marrows after having multiply relapsed disease. But it also means that just because you kill these cells that we can see doesn't mean that we're curing these patients. And we don't know what the long-term curve is going to look like. But at least we know that even having responded doesn't mean that you're cured. And that's sort of the name of the game with myeloma, right? We consider it an incurable disease. So where do we see this going? Maybe we shouldn't be getting patients with 7 or 8 lines of therapy and then taking them to CAR T. Perhaps we should use it earlier, either in a first, for example, 1 to 3 relapses, like 1 to 3 lines like daratumumab has been approved, or even more proximally, potentially in place of or in consolidation to autologous stem cell transplant. Would that be a way that we might be able to use this optimally? One of the great things about CAR T is that it's a one and done. You do it and then you don't have anything afterwards. And I have to tell you, that's a huge quality of life change for a lot of our patients, although there's always the anxiety of progression, as there is with any of this.
Consolidation CAR T after transplant.
Correct. So the idea there would be that you get your initial induction therapy, you get your transplant with the melphalan. All of that is chemo-based therapy, and particularly the transplant is alkylator-based. So that gets to the bulk of the disease that you can see. But what about cells that you can't see? Perhaps BCMA-based CAR T therapy as a consolidation, for example, instead of a tandem transplant, would be the way to approach this in a different mechanism of action and sweep up what the transplant could not get.
So what about this idea of using some kind of maintenance treatment after CAR T? You know, in other lymphomas, et cetera, it's like a one and done type thing, as you were saying. Maybe myeloma requires more continuous therapy.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point and something that is being explored. There is some preclinical data to suggest that lenalidomide may augment the function of CAR T cells. And so wouldn't that be a good option to consider after CAR T cell therapy? This is probably going to be explored in an upcoming multi-center cooperative group trial where we'll be looking at CAR T therapy and then employing lenalidomide maintenance after that. The good thing about that is, you know, you're trying to immunostimulate whatever CAR Ts are there. Also, lenalidomide itself has a prohibitive effect on myeloma, inhibitory effect. The bad thing is people want to get off therapy, right? So that's a cost. That's a cytopenias. There's side effects. There's adverse events. There's secondary malignancies. All of these things have to be taken into consideration. So we don't know the right answer, but I think it's a small enough step beyond what we're used to consider doing after CAR T. And I think that's probably going to be one of the next steps for CAR T in myeloma space.
You know, it's interesting kind of looking at this from the outside, you know, how, you know, diffuse large B cell, if you use upfront regular therapy, R-CHOP, et cetera, you see a number of people getting cured. And then CAR T seems to have a very dramatic effect. And with myeloma, you don't see that. Any thoughts biologically about why?
Yeah, my personal opinion, and this is not based on data, but this is just based on my opinion, is that the myeloma CAR T is killing the cells that we see, and the BCMA is on the cells that are causing problems, causing plasmacytomas, causing anemia, et cetera. But it's not killing the myeloma progenitor cell, the myeloma stem cell, if you will, because those cells may not express BCMA. We actually don't know what those cells are, but it's very clear to us that patients can be MRD negative and then years later progress. And that means there's some dormant cell there that's either not identified or is not sufficiently present in quantity for us to identify it. And so my thought is that probably we're killing the myeloma cells that express BCMA, but we're not killing the progenitor cells that then develop months later that eventually will maybe express BCMA again once they differentiate more, but in their progenitor state do not.
So early on, as we were hearing about CAR T and myeloma, it seemed like maybe there wasn't as much toxicity issues with cytokine release and neurologic syndromes. Has that continued to be the case? And again, if so, why?
Yeah, that's a really good point. So myeloma CAR-T is not the same as ALL CAR-T when it comes to toxicities. And I think the first thing is that the patients are completely different and the diseases are different. And so there was some fear initially because myeloma patients actually tend to be older and very heavily pretreated. But as it turns out, the rate of CRS was about 67%, which is not so bad. And it was mainly grade 1 and 2. I think we have the advantage of being the second child here, so we know that you can use tocilizumab and it doesn't seem to alter the efficacy of the CAR T cells, and so we're more likely to use it. The protocols become a little bit more permissive of this, and we've also become more experienced. The neurotoxicity is present, but really in a smaller degree. Again, we've learned how to manage that a little bit more quickly and effectively. We're less worried about giving dexamethasone in small doses, and we want to prevent people from having things like cerebral edema or seizures. So the neurotoxicity has been actually fairly manageable, and I think part of that is because the blood-brain barrier is different from myeloma versus ALL, and also because of our experience with CAR-T and jumping on things sooner than later.
I'm kind of curious how this actually plays out clinically. And you have a young patient, 61-year-old man, who ended up getting CAR-T therapy. What happened there?
Yeah, so this guy came to me. He looked like your garden variety myeloma patient when I saw him initially. He didn't have any high-risk cytogenetics. But one thing I noticed about him is he kind of kinetically was high risk in the sense that he'd have a response and just his M protein would start to uptick very slightly, very quickly after pausing therapy. So he initially got lenalidomide, bortezomib, and dexamethasone, went into, I think, a VGPR, went on to transplant, and he was on actually a clinical trial to look at ixazomib, lenalidomide, dexamethasone consolidation as planned consolidation and actually progressed by M protein during this time. So he's taken off study. And then he went on a CD38 antibody study that we had at our institution and did well there for a few cycles, but then progressed after that. And when he progressed at that time, he had pretty high burden disease. So I actually admitted him to the hospital and gave him cyclophosphamide-based therapy just to reduce his disease burden. He tolerated that well and then went on to outpatient pomalidomide, cyclophosphamide, and dexamethasone therapy, or Pomcy-Dex, which has been shown to be also a good salvage regimen for patients who haven't seen those drugs. I thought he was responsive to alkylators, and that's why I chose that. But very soon after that, a couple of cycles later, he started to show progression. And so now he had had 3 lines. He had had exposure to anti-CD38 antibodies, so he went on to get enrolled in a CAR T-cell trial. And, you know, he was in pretty good shape otherwise, had good social support. We thought he'd be a good candidate. So he went on, and he was one of the few people that I didn't need to give bridging therapy to in between collecting the cells and giving the cells. And so he went into the CAR-T study with a very good amount of disease, a pretty high burden of disease.
Could I just ask, how long does it take from the time you collect the cells to the time you reinfuse them?
It's about 5 weeks. And that's not so much related to production, but also related to QC and things you have to be careful about, you know, because it's a product coming from somewhere else. So this is all necessary time right now. It may be shorter in the future. So that sometimes requires that patients get what we call bridging therapy in between, because they really can't be 5 weeks without any therapy. And remembering that before you get those cells collected, you already have to have 2 weeks that you don't have any therapy because you don't want your lymphocytes to be affected by steroids, et cetera. So patients can't be off therapy for 2 months. You know, it's too much for them. So a lot of them do require bridging therapy. This particular patient did not, but by the time he came to our CAR-T part of it with the lymphodepleting chemotherapy and CAR T cells, he really did have a pretty significant amount of disease. So he got the therapy, actually did fairly well, had a grade 1 CRS and was treated successfully with tocilizumab.
Did you admit him to the hospital to start the treatment?
Right. So most of the protocols are requiring initial admission for the first 2 weeks of CAR-T. That's not a definitive, and I think ultimately we'll be able to do a lot of this as an outpatient. But at least for this particular type of study, we decided we had to admit him for the first 2 weeks of the therapy.
So if they feel well, they're just sitting around for 2 weeks?
Correct. Yeah, that's it can get kind of boring, actually. But it's a necessary factor for this type of treatment right now as we're just learning about it.
So you said he had grade 1 CRS. Can you talk about exactly what happened and the timing of how it happened?
Sure. So in this particular case, at the time we were using the Lee criteria, which had been developed for CRS grading, and I think in the future we'll be using the CTCAE criteria, which is a more collaborative group criteria between all of the centers and leaders that have used CAR-T therapy. But putting that aside, We did use a Lee criteria here. And in that situation, if you have a fever only without any other vital sign instability, meaning no hypotension or no hypoxia, then you're still at grade one. Kind of interesting, right? Because you can have a fever of 39 persistently and still be a grade one CRS. And I think in this situation, the patient had had persistent fever, and so we decided to give the tocilizumab, and he responded well to it. I think he also had a complicating factor of a rhinovirus, so that may have also been adding to the fever. But it seemed pretty consistent with CAR T-cell because it happened within the first 24 to 48 hours of infusion of cells. So we treated the patient as if he had CRS, and he actually did respond to the tocilizumab. And as soon as that was over, it was like the rest of the time he was just hanging out, you know, in the hospital, no major issues. And that's kind of what you want to see, because you want to feel safe about these patients that you're giving an experimental therapy to. And so we were pleased with that, and he got discharged on time. He did have a few cytopenias in the weeks after the CAR T-cells, and this is a known complication of CAR T-cell therapy in myeloma, that some patients take a few months to recover their counts. Usually, the neutrophils are good to go by the 30-day mark and the platelets by the 60-day mark, but there are some people that may require a little more close follow-up. But he did pretty well and eventually, you know, was able to go home and has been being followed up off treatment since then.
Can you talk a little bit about grade two and beyond CRS? What are the clinical manifestations and how often you see this in myeloma?
Yeah, so the grade two CRS, I would say the most common hallmarks are either hypoxia, so O2 sat below 90%, or hypotension, whether or not it responds to fluids or not. So again, I'm using the Lee criteria. And so once you have one of those, you start to get a little bit worried. And that's one of the cases that we generally say, okay, you should definitely be using tocilizumab, although you don't have to, because if you're getting to a systolic pressure of 88 and the patient immediately responds after a liter of fluids and looks great, then you don't necessarily have to give tocilizumab. But, you know, every clinical case is different. And so as you get to grade three CRS, you need more pressor support and you have end organ manifestations. And obviously grade four is requiring ICU support, et cetera. So really most patients hover in the grade one and then fairly rarely in the grade two. Grade three is pretty uncommon, actually. And a persistent grade three CRS, something like that, would be considered a cause to look at the study again and make sure that the safety is appropriate.
Any correlation between these toxicity issues and benefit?
Yeah, so I think what I'd be able to say just from looking at all the data that's been presented, and there have been many CAR T studies presented, is that not having any CRS is probably a bad thing. You probably want to have at least a little bit of CRS. People who don't have any CRS tend not to respond. But just because you had CRS doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to respond or that you'll respond for a long time. So it's sort of a way to weed out who probably isn't going to benefit, but doesn't say anything about the people who had it if they're definitely going to benefit.
What about the neurologic issues? When do you see them and what do you see?
Yeah, neurological issues are still being learned about more. Neurotoxicity can occur anytime in the first month after CAR T. Typically, it occurs within the first 14 days. Some of the earlier reports had it as late as day 11, but sometimes it can occur more soon. And it's hard sometimes to tease it out from CRS, right? Because if you have a patient who's 68 and has a fever of 39, they may be a little bit confused, and that wouldn't necessarily say that they had neurotoxicity. One of the things that's very interesting about neurotoxicity associated with CAR T versus garden variety CTCAE grading neurotoxicity is that it really manifests as this sort of dysarthria, dysgraphia. Patients can't really quite speak what they want to say. They almost have like an aphasia. They're a little bit confused, but it's not that they're having a full-on paralysis or inability, you know, for functional ADLs, as you say. You know, they just are really confused. And I guess the best way to describe it is they almost seem a little drunk. And that is one of the hallmarks of the CAR T-associated neurotoxicity as it pertains to what we know so far, which is more based on CD19 CAR T therapy, not so much on myeloma therapy because it's less vetted out and much younger. So it's a little bit different than your garden variety neurotoxicity you would talk about in internal medicine.
I can't remember whether this might have been CD19 or not, but I heard stories about subtle neurologic things that unless you ask, you know, people not being able to use their phone or whatever. Do you see that? And did you see anything like that in this man?
Yeah, there are really subtle elements of neurotoxicity. I totally agree with that. And that's sort of why the CARTOX 10 was invented. It's a quick and easy tool to apply, and it does require the patient to write. And handwriting is one of the things that is one of the first to go. And if you think about it, it does require the brain processing something, spitting it back out to the hand, and a fine motor coordination. So it really does encompass a lot of things that's necessary for functional brain activity. And so this has been nicely used as a tool. And so you really won't notice unless you ask. If you just ask a patient, hey, do you know where you are, what day it is? That's not a good enough assessment, because a lot of patients will have been told right before you walk in the room, you know, it's today is Tuesday, or, you know, I know where I am and I know what my name is. But a functional task is probably a better way to assess these people.
How easy or difficult is it for someone to enter a CAR T trial in myeloma nowadays?
I have to say this has been one of the most challenging aspects of being a clinical trialist in myeloma. We have a therapy that we know is effective. We don't know for how long, but we know it's effective. A lot of people are running out of options, and we'd love to give this therapy to many people. Unlike other studies, phase two studies where there's slots open, or a phase one study where you know when your slot is going to be, it's really determined by a factory requirement, right? Because the company has to produce the cells, and there has to be a slot of space open for that. So that's the logistical aspect. And then the patient aspect is also difficult, because many of these CAR T studies are asking for patients to be actively progressing when they enroll. So imagine that you have a patient who has gone through three lines of therapy, including daratumumab, is actively progressing, and now they're eligible to get on that study. And all you know is that slot is now available for apheresis 4 weeks from now. So you have to stop therapy 2 weeks from now. They still have to be progressing. They have to be off therapy for 2 weeks. Then they can get bridging therapy. Then they can get the CAR T therapy after a few weeks of bridging therapy after it's been made. So you really box these patients in. You have to, if a patient is progressing but not too sick, right? They have to have the blood counts that are sufficient for it. They have to have cardiac status, pulmonary status sufficient for it. They can't have very many comorbidities, can't be on anticoagulation. So it really starts to filter out a lot of patients, understandably, because we're doing something on trial and we don't want to do anything harmful to the patients. And we also want to show that these are the worst of the worst as far as myeloma goes, and that we're still having efficacy. So I think all these factors together make it challenging for us to get patients on the clinical trial. But unfortunately, there are so many patients that we're generally able to find someone who fits the bill.
At this point, ideally, in terms of, you know, actual benefiting the patient in front of you, when do you think the optimal time is, or clinical scenario, to actually use CAR T?
I am not completely sure, but I don't think we should have people with three lines of therapy progressing. I think one good option would be patients who've had 1 to 3 prior lines, and they may be responding to this third line that they've had, or the second line they've had. They're not in extremis, right? So they have the ability to take some time, get off therapy, get apheresed. They're not so beaten up that they won't make enough CAR T cells, and that they can wait to get the therapy. And then when you treat them, they're less likely, maybe, potentially, to have some toxicities if their tumor burden isn't so great. They've also had less a chance to have clonal evolution as well. So I think that's where we're headed. I don't know that for sure, but I think that's going to give us better chance to make a long-term effect from the CAR T therapy.
So how about other BCMA-based strategies?
Antibody-drug conjugates have been used in other malignancies, including, as you know, AML and ALL. So this is a similar drug. Now, this is targeting BCMA with a warhead, an MMAE warhead. And the idea here is that once it targets BCMA, it deploys the warhead inside and allows for lysosomal-based cell disintegration. So it's very targeted. And of course, the secondary effects can be that this toxin can then be having secondary off-target effects, because once it's unleashed, it may, you know, diffuse out. And so from an efficacy standpoint, it's been very efficacious, over 60% response rate. And actually, the PFS in the final publication was 12 months, which is basically the same as CAR T. So I think that's something that's going to be competing in that CAR T space for patients who have relapse therapy who might not be candidates for CAR T. I do want to point out that the patients were a little less heavily pretreated in that study. I think the requirement was at least 2 prior lines, and the median was 5. So that's a little bit less heavily pretreated than CAR T. So not exactly the same population, but pretty similar. The most important thing I think that we've taken away from that is not just the efficacy, but then on the flip side, the side effects. So whereas the toxicities for CAR T are very immediate and profound CRS, and patients are in the hospital, In this case, the toxicities we're concerned about are corneal toxicities because of the side effects of the toxin. And this is known with this type of antibody drug conjugate therapy that this is a possibility. And if I'm not mistaken, I think like 60% of patients had a grade 1 or 2. And I may be mistaken in that number. But what's important is that anybody who's ever had a cornea scratch knows it's very annoying. So you have to really make sure that you educate your patients well if you're going to get this therapy, that there's a chance for corneal toxicity. And the investigators were really good about assessing this. They had ophthalmologic counterparts, collaborators to help with this. And this may be something that can help patients be assessed. Also, judicious use of rewetting drops, et cetera, to prevent this from further causing issues. This study did have a limitation of courses of therapy, so I think that was actually a good thing because it's not saying you have to treat patients indefinitely. But I have to say, it really had some very nice efficacy and PFS data, so I think it's going to be a pretty good competitor, particularly because this is something that eventually would be able to be given in the community. You don't have to send your patient to a specialized CAR T center to get this therapy. So I think there's going to be a role for this type of therapy.
So the other obvious question that we've heard about, and we first start hearing about BiTEs with ALL, blinatumomab, you know, I've heard people call it off-the-shelf CAR T. What about BCMA BiTEs?
Yeah, BCMA BiTEs have also taken on their own new life. And the most public data that we have is with AMG-420, which was presented both at ASH and recently at ASCO, which is a phase 1 continuous infusion BCMA targeting BiTE therapy. And a couple of things, you know, the data is really early. So although there's efficacy and a very nice efficacy with the dose they've proceeded with for the recommended phase 2 dose, we don't know the length of time that this will be efficacious yet. We're hopeful because of the previous data and history with ALL, but myeloma is a different disease. And so you have to wonder, you know, how long do I have to treat these patients? Because in ALL, they could technically go to an allo transplant. And in fact, many patients did in that study, in the Blina study. So here we have a different endpoint. We really need to know the duration of response. And something interesting that was pointed out was the toxicities, which included pneumonias, some of which were serious, and a very interesting 2 cases of polyneuropathy, which I don't know the exact details of because I'm not an investigator on the study. But from what I can gather, it seems like I'm kind of a Guillain-Barré type of polyneuropathy. So not your usual neurotoxicity or neuropathy that you think about with myeloma patients with bortezomib, but truly what might be an off-target sort of autoinflammatory neuropathy, not in all patients, as I said, only 2 cases, but significant enough that this was mentioned in the presentation. I think these things will probably be sorted out as we get more experience, much like our experience with CAR T and CRS. But something that we really do have to consider is this easier than CAR T because it's off the shelf? If it's easier, then how much easier can it get? Can we get longer acting BiTEs that don't need continuous infusion? And there are several trials ongoing looking at those. That's 1. And 2, how long do we have to treat these patients? How long before their T cells may get exhausted? And if that's the case, will 8 months of BiTE therapy be the same cost as 1 CAR T, and which patients would be suited for each? And I think a lot of this is going to play into health economics, and that's going to be a major deciding factor in the ultimate use of all of these therapies.
That's interesting. I know blinatumomab also is given by continuous infusion, which is you know, not easy to deal with, I know. But also there you see CRS and I think maybe even neurologic syndromes. Do you see that with these kinds of BiTEs, the BCMA BiTEs, CRS?
You can see it in the first couple, you know, the first treatment, and then it gets more manageable as time goes on. So very similar story. And again, we're less scared of CRS now because we know how to manage it, and so we're willing to take that risk for patients who are so multiply relapsed. So I'm really encouraged by the BiTE data, and I think it's like a cool computer that needs to be made cooler or smaller or more compact. We have a desktop that needs to be made into a laptop kind of thing, and I hope that happens. So we're encouraged because, again, not all patients can get CAR T, and this might be a way to really harness the patient's own immune system in an off-the-shelf fashion, not necessarily requiring processing. So I think it will have an upcoming role in the treatment for relapsed myeloma.
So let's talk about a couple more of your cases. How about this 83-year-old man?
Yeah, so this is actually one of my patients who 2 years ago, when he had just turned 81, he was diagnosed with myeloma and presented with profound light chains, lambda light chain myeloma, basically. Otherwise, totally healthy. So he came to my practice and he said, I feel great, but apparently I have this disease. I said, okay. So we started out with Cyborg-D, which I think is, as you know, cyclophosphamide, bortezomib, and dexamethasone, and something that's pretty well tolerated in this age group. He had a little bit of renal insufficiency at the time, and that's why I steered away from lenalidomide. But I really wanted to remind myself that triple therapy is something you can give elderly patients. You just have to watch them and be very careful with the adverse events. But if you really talk to them and make sure you're checking up on them and watch their counts and their toxicities, it is something that is useful and also is probably more effective than doublet therapy. So I wanted to give him the chance to get that. And he did get triplet therapy for 6 cycles and actually was in a VGPR thereafter. And at that time, his renal function had improved and he looked great. You know, he was taking various trips to Europe with his wife and family. So we then started lenalidomide maintenance therapy at 10 milligrams daily for 21 out of 28 days, which he surprisingly tolerated well. He does have some grade 1 fatigue, but he says he can tolerate that. And he jokes to me, he's not sure if it's the fatigue from being 80 or 83 now, or whether it's actually the lenalidomide. But now, in light of what we know about what I would say transplant ineligible patients, first, I want to say that this patient was not necessarily transplant ineligible by age, but more by desire. He just didn't want to go through a transplant. And I thought that was an appropriate decision as he was 81 at the time. And I said, okay, that's fine.
Just out of curiosity, you recommended or brought up transplant to him at age 81?
We brought it up because, you know, we think about functional status, not necessarily age. And I'd say just my own practice, 80 is kind of the limit for me. You know, even a MEL 140, I'd probably, you know, not go past much of that. But you know, it's something I always bring up. I never want to be looking at just age alone. But he himself didn't want to do it. And maybe part of me was relieved about that. But he chose not to do it. And I said, that's fine. Now we have more data about what could we have done in this situation. So now we have the MAIA data. And that looked at transplant-ineligible patients and randomized them to get daratumumab, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone versus lenalidomide and dexamethasone. And the upshot is patients did great. The median PFS in the triplet arm hasn't even been reached. The curves separated out pretty easily and quickly. And we are going to get more information. Almost all subgroups benefited, except the high-risk subgroup seems to have less benefit, but that may be a numbers issue. One thing that's different about this study, it's not just a triplet versus doublet. It's the maintenance aspect, which also incorporates the daratumumab with lenalidomide, not just lenalidomide alone. So the patients in the experimental arm got DRD and then DR maintenance versus the RD and then R maintenance. I think, yeah, I made a joke about this on Twitter. If I had a dime for every time the triplet versus doublet was better, you know, the triplets are always better than the doublet. So I think that's an important thing to take away. We should really be using triplets if we can. But I think something really important here is that this therapy was actually pretty well tolerated. And patients stayed on study. You know, they stayed on and they didn't have a significantly worse adverse event profile, although there are, you know, infusion reactions, et cetera, as you would expect. What does this mean? It means that, one, we have another option for triplet therapy for quote-unquote transplant-ineligible patients, and two, that patients are willing to take this for a long time. Maybe the high-risk patients aren't the best for this therapy. We don't know that yet, but it is another tool in our box. And I think one thing that we have to consider with these types of patients is, why are they transplant-ineligible? If your answer is because they have too many comorbidities, which may include dialysis or renal failure, this might not be the right option for them because they'll have to get lenalidomide and you'd have to underdose the lenalidomide versus the study dosing that was here. And maybe in that case, you would choose something like cyclophosphamide, bortezomib, and dexamethasone. But if all things are similar to the patient population, I think this adds another option for us as far as what we can offer these patients who want to get triple therapy, immunotherapy, who are fit, but don't necessarily want to proceed with the transplant.
Do you think there's any rationale to say, well, maybe we should save Dara for the relapse setting?
Yeah, there's a sort of camp of people who believe that. And we always joke in our practice, you know, if you had the best basketball player, would you save them on the bench or would you put them out in front? We've done remarkably well with upfront treatment for myeloma, and all the gains that we have made have been in that setting. Now, we've done also very well in the 1 to 3 priors, but once you get past the second and third progression, it's really hard to keep people in remission. And so some people say, okay, I'd like to save that. We don't know what the right answer is to sequence, and unfortunately, that study is probably not going to be done. So it really comes down to a style thing. I do tend to save daratumumab at least for the second, but that's because we don't have as many trials that show Dara in the upfront, although that is changing now. We have several trials showing benefit of daratumumab in the upfront setting, and more trials are coming. So I think that that will be a question for all of us to philosophically go through, you know, should we use it now or use it later? What will also change that will be what we have for later. So if it turns out that CAR T for early relapses results in a 5-year PFS, okay, fine, then I would be willing to use Dara up front and save CAR T for later. So everything interplays with each other.